Radical love, lavish generosity, extravagant forgiveness, inclusive hospitality, compassionate action, selfless service, a passion for justice, creative nonviolence, simple living. Good day, good people. I'm Robert Farrell. This is Coalesce. Thank you for joining me. Coalesce is grounded in both and thinking, heart wisdom, and listening for the common good arising in dialogue, where we are present to presence. Coalesce provides an opportunity to encounter and discover the multiple perspectives that make our beautiful community. May we see with the eyes of our heart. May we love one another with peace and compassion. May all beings come to know the divine presence within. This is episode 11, Jesus, Profound Wisdom Guide. Last episode, we looked at the ways in which Jesus was a quintessential Jew. This week, we will see how he also seemed to positively enact Isaiah's four beautiful servant songs. Isaiah has these four servant songs in Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 4, Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 6, Isaiah 50, verses 4 through 9, and Isaiah 52, verse 13, through 53, verse 12. These four passages show amazing, prescient knowledge of what it would take to move history from the myth of redemptive violence to the truth of redemptive suffering. Even though Jesus walked and exemplified this upside-down notion of a Messiah, most Christians merely worshipped and admired it in him, i.e., substitutionary atonement theory. Instead of imitating such a transformative pattern in their own lives, too easy worship is a clever disguise for actual imitation. Let's take a look at Isaiah 50, beginning with verse 4, to see how Jesus lived these servant songs. Verse 4, "The Lord God has given me a well-trained tongue, for me to know how to give a word of comfort to the weary." Jesus' ministry was one of teaching and healing, and his healings were usually audio-visual aids for his teachings. He comforted the weary, whereas the church largely kept saving the saved. Jesus seemed to be into universal health care. And now we make it a privilege for a few instead of a basic need and right. The second part of verse 4, "Each morning he wakes me to hear, to listen like a disciple. The Lord Yahweh has opened my ear." Jesus learned how to listen long and hard before every major decision and before he even began to speak publicly around the age of 30. Verse 5, "For my part, I made no resistance, neither did I turn away." Jesus clearly taught and lived nonviolence his entire life, up to and including his death. We could not admit or see this once we were attached to using violence. Jesus moved into the pain of the world to reveal it, to identify with it, and thus to transform it. We largely inflicted pain on others to prove ourselves right. Verse 6, "I offered my back to those who struck me, my cheek to those who tore at my beard. I did not cover my face against insult and spittle." Jesus' passion and death exemplified in dramatic theater this third way, which is neither fight nor flight, but a little of both. it is fleeing enough to detach oneself from excessive ego and the emotions that attach to it, and fighting just enough to stand up courageously against evil, paying the price for change yourself. Such a third way, I believe, is the unique pattern of the gospel. It neither plays the victim nor creates victims of others. How rare is this even today? Mark likely wrote his gospel around 65 to 70 AD, much closer to the time of Jesus than the other evangelists. He gave us a picture of Jesus which was very close to the preachings of the apostles, but in a different context, and with a very definite emphasis and intention. Mark began writing shortly after the great persecution of Rome, 64 AD, in which both Peter and Paul had been martyred. They began to see where Jesus' message finally led people. Until then, the Gentile converts in Rome had experienced largely the glory of Christ, it seems. The purpose of Mark's gospel was therefore to remind Christians who acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah that Jesus walked a path of suffering servanthood. We Christians say glibly that we are saved by the death and resurrection of Jesus, but seem to understand this as some kind of heavenly transaction on his part, instead of an earthly transformation on his and our part. We need to deeply trust and allow both our own dyings and our own certain resurrections, just as Jesus did. This is the full pattern of transformation. If we trust both, we are indestructible. That is how Jesus saves us from meaninglessness, cynicism, hatred, and violence, which is indeed death. God is light, yet this full light is hidden in darkness, so only the sincere seeker finds it. It seems we all must go into darkness to see the light, which is counterintuitive for the ego. Our age and culture resist this language of descent. We made Christianity instead into a religion of ascent, where Jesus became a self-help guru instead of a profound wisdom guide who really transformed our mind and heart. Reason, medicine, wealth, technology, and speed, all good in themselves, have allowed us to avoid the quite normal and ordinary path of the fall, as a way to transform the separate and superior self into a much larger identity that we call God. As a profound wisdom guide, Jesus recognized the value of quiet to transform our mind and heart. We see this in several places in Scripture, including Mark 6:31, where he says, "Come with me to a quiet place and rest a while." So, come with me to a quiet place and rest a while. With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in silence. Be still for 1 minute. Isaiah 42:1. Here is my servant, whom I uphold, my chosen one, in whom my soul delights. I have sent my spirit upon him. He will bring fair judgment to the nations. This is the first of Isaiah's servant songs, foreshadowing Jesus' baptism in the Jordan River. Directly following his baptism, the Spirit sent Jesus into the desert for his own initiation rite, deliberate exile from business as usual, fasting, temptation, and then encounter. From this experience, Jesus went into Galilee and proclaimed, "The time has come, the reign of God is here. Turn around and believe the good news." Mark 1:15. The rest of Jesus' life, his ministry, passion, and death, would be dedicated to teaching and living out this good news, which is for all of us a great turning around. It is even a turning upside down of the usual Promethean attempts to climb up to God. It seems we cannot allow God to come down to us, which is the meaning of the incarnation. We think we have to climb up to God by Herculean efforts and willpower to show ourselves as superior, separate, pure, and saved. That's the ego's needs to feel significant and worthy. But we are already worthy, and it doesn't have anything to do with our efforts. A sincere yes to our inherent dignity is all that's needed every day. The true self is worthy by virtue of its objective union with a living, merciful God from the moment of our conception. Such good news is always and forever too good to believe. The only ones who got it in the Bible were those who desired it desperately, those who suffered and or were outside the usual system of success. The excluded sinners, the disabled, the Gentiles, the lepers, all of whom were aware of their powerlessness and utter need for social mercy. Of course, the freedom and inner authority that this empowerment gave was a threat to the power and the job security of the comfortable church and state. And this pattern has not changed. The heart of Jesus' teaching was the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5-7. Together with his parables, many of which are about losing and then finding, the lost son, the lost coin, the lost sheep, all of these teachings and Jesus' lived example call us to win by losing, which is so countercultural and so paradoxical that Jesus finally had to live it himself to show us it could be true. The Sermon on the Mount begins with the so-called 8 Beatitudes, Matthew 5:3-12. Read them from the perspective of how they describe Jesus as the suffering servant. The first beatitude, "How happy are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Meister Eckhart from the 14th century said that to be poor in spirit is to know nothing, want nothing, and have nothing. That sounds a lot like Buddhism, and this is Jesus' opening line. The second beatitude, "Happy the gentle. They shall have the earth for their heritage." This is so contrary to our love of power, certitude, and control. Who of us really believes this? Could you ever build an empire or even an institution with this kind of naivete? The third beatitude, "Happy those who mourn, they shall be comforted." We now know that grief is a privileged portal into soul work and transformation. The fourth and fifth beatitude, "Happy those who hunger and thirst for what is right. they shall be satisfied. Happy are the merciful, they shall have mercy shown them. This is a perfect correlation between how we give and what we can receive. Consider this for the rest of your life. And the last three Beatitudes. Happy the pure in heart, they shall see God. Happy the peacemakers, they shall be called children of God. Happy those who are persecuted in the cause of right, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Each of these invitations, for that is what they are concerned about vulnerable and outpouring relationship, which is necessary for the second half of life. In the same way that the Ten Commandments serve for ego identity in the first half of life. The Beatitudes are descriptions of a mature human person, much more than prescriptions for otherworldly salvation. They offer something astoundingly new to human consciousness, which is a lifestyle based on vulnerability, mutuality, service, and thus a willingness to be usable for God, history, healing, and one another. So let us follow Jesus when he says, "Come with me to a quiet place and rest a while." With eyes closed and hands on heart, rest in the silence, be still for 1 minute. After teaching his disciples plainly and in parables, after showing them miracles of healing and forgiveness, and after sending them off to do likewise, Jesus asks the 12 who they think he is. Peter answers in good doctrinal form, "You are the Christ," Mark 8:29. His apostles may understand that Jesus is the Messiah, but they have their own ideas of what a Messiah ought to be. They do not yet realize that the salvation Christ will bring is not an easy victory. They have not yet connected Jesus with the figure of the suffering servant in Isaiah. Mark wanted his own community to understand this connection. It took the 12 a long time to comprehend it, so Mark repeats the point 3 separate times between chapters 8, 9, and 10. Each time, Jesus tells the apostles that the Messiah must suffer and die, with clear implications that they must do the same. Each time they miss the point, and in fact, they do the opposite. Our first pope, Peter, had the right doctrine and words, but no intention of changing his career track. He was thinking of success the way most people do and wanted to use Jesus to get there. But Jesus told Peter and the apostles that the real way to succeed is quite different. From Mark 8:34 through 35, anyone who wants to be a follower of mine has to put self aside, shoulder his or her cross, and go the way that I go. Whoever holds on to his or her life will lose it, but whoever lets go of his or her life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. More and more people today are finally beginning to understand that this is not a call to willful or heroic asceticism, but something that demands much more of the ego. The self we need to let go of is our falsely concocted identity, so that the true self, or the self we eternally are in God, can then naturally emerge. It is almost that simple and always that hard. We are attached to our personas, careers, masks, and agendas. They do not die easily, and yet they surely will. Jesus is very patient with his disciples, which is good news for all of us. We also have a hard time understanding the Paschal mystery, which is indeed a deep mystery, that the way up is the way down. The way Jesus leads and teaches is not the way we usually want to go. Let's be completely honest about that. Hardly anyone goes willingly. It is often done unto us. Right after Jesus told the disciples a second time, in Mark 9:31, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of people who will put him to death, but 3 days after he is killed, he will rise. Then the disciples start arguing about which of them was the most important. You might laugh or cry at how the disciples missed the point. So Jesus sat down, called the 12 around him, and explained in Mark 9:34 through 35, anyone who wants to be the most important has to be the least important, the servant of all the others. Just like the 12, we usually want to be on top, but Jesus calls us to be free and happy at the bottom. We all want to be the boss, but he tells us to be servants. A third time, as Jesus and the disciples were heading for Jerusalem, Jesus again explained how he will suffer, die, and rise. Mark 10, verses 33 through 34. Yet, how did his disciples respond? James and John asked if they could sit in glory at his side when he established the Messianic kingdom. Mark 10, 35 through 37. You can almost hear the sigh and sadness in the depths of Jesus' heart when he heard their request. He turned to them and said in Mark 10:38, "You do not know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup that I will drink, or be immersed in the same bath that I will be immersed in?" Jesus was trying to bring them back to reality, the inevitable reality of human life. The other disciples became indignant when they heard what James and John were asking. Once again, Jesus had to explain to them in Mark 10, verses 42 through 45. You know how the so-called rulers of nations like to lord it over the people? And how those at the top like to make their authority felt? Well, with you it has to be different. If you want to be important, serve others. The Son of Man himself did not come to be served, but to serve, to give life so that everyone might be set free. Jesus offered the world a new pattern of power and leadership, which few in church or state have ever really agreed with. If only the church had shared Jesus' bias toward the bottom the past 2,000 years. If only we had seriously believed him, how much sooner we would have seen the coming of peace and justice on this earth. If only we had truly listened to the gospel, how differently Western history would have unfolded. Instead, we have made easy and happy friends with power, prestige, perks, and possessions, even in the name of God and the church. Let us follow Jesus in his words, where he says, "Come with me to a quiet place and rest a while." With eyes closed and hands on heart, Rest in the silence. Be still for 1 minute. This week's practice is titled Self-Emptying. Let me begin with the passage from Philippians 2, verses 3 through 8. Make my joy complete by being of a single mind, one in love, one in heart, and one in mind. Nothing is to be done of jealousy or vanity. Instead, out of humility of mind, everyone should give preference to others. Everyone pursuing not selfish interest, but those of others. Make your own the mind of Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not count equality with God something to be grasped. But he emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, becoming as human beings are, and being in every way like a human being. He was humbler, yet even to accepting death. Death on a cross. Jesus consistently asked people to come after me or to follow me. Well, we see where he's leading us, to the cross. Victory is not the avoidance of death, but precisely death transformed. And that is what God does with people who say yes to the process. In the passage that I read from Philippians, Paul uses the Greek word kenosis to describe Jesus' act of self-emptying and surrender. Contemplative prayer is a practice of self-emptying. At its most basic, contemplation is letting go of our habitual thoughts, preferences, judgments, and feelings. Though life itself is often our most powerful teacher, through great love and great suffering, contemplation is a daily small death to false self and ego. It makes space for true self to reappear, to rise from the ashes of our partial and protected self. If you do not already have a regular contemplative or meditative practice, I encourage you to begin with a few minutes of silence every day. Empty your mind of patterned, mostly negative thoughts, to simply be present to presence, and to follow Jesus when he says, "Come with me to a quiet place and rest a while." Thank you for being with me. May the long time sun shine upon you, all love surround you, and the pure light within you guide your way on.